Well, congratulations again, you survivors. This is the third round and the last round, in which we're going to be looking at the history of the church in South Africa. In a way, it's advantageous to do it this way, because everything that's come to South Africa has come from the outside and from with its own history. So you've already had the background, as it were. And we will see how all the various kinds of Christianity, Roman Catholic, Dutch Reformed and Methodist and Newer Charismatic and Pentecostal and Baptist, and then of course finally South Africa's own unique generation of its own kinds of Christianity we will look at. It's a fascinating story. It's a very complex story, and like everything, we'll have to look at it briefly. I'm going to divide this into three periods. This is purely, well, it's not totally arbitrary. It's three political periods. The Dutch period, the British period, and the, let's call it the Afrikaner period. We could call it the white period. Basically, with reference to who's in charge. The Dutch period, we will define about 150 years from 1652 to 1800. The British period, we will define from 1800 to 1910. And then the last period from 1910 to 1994. You'll notice they're progressively longer to short. The Dutch period is a period of about 150 years. Now, it was in 1652 that about 90 employees of the Dutch East India Company landed in the Cape of Good Hope with the purpose of establishing a refreshment station here, which could help the ships on their way to what we now call the Indonesia, the Dutch East Indies. It wasn't their intention to form a colony. That's why South Africa never became an America. In fact, they strictly tried to control, because the Dutch East Indies Company didn't want the hassle of managing a colony, and in the beginning, they wanted to keep it. In fact, they even forbade farming. They said, we will simply trade with the indigenous people, the Khoi people, and buy products off them and give to the ships. But it wasn't always such a reliable source. And furthermore, there was pressure by some of the Dutch immigrants to want to start farms. And kind of almost by default, gradually the refreshment station slowly, but very slowly, became a kind of a colony. Everything was slow about the Dutch period. It was the beginning of official Christianity. Now, one can say that there were some Roman Catholics like Vasco da Gama and Bartholomew Dias who touched in. But in terms of a settled community of people calling themselves Christian, meeting together to worship God, we can say that in South Africa we have that from 1652. So that's about 370 years ago. It's not a long history, is it? Now, the first period didn't break any records of church growth. To begin with, only one church was allowed, the Dutch Reformed Church. And that was a reflection of what was characteristic in Europe at that time. The tendency was for churches to be state churches and to be restricted to, you know, one particular church. So the Dutch Reformed Church was the only legally permitted church, and in 150 years, it grew from one congregation to seven. Like I say, no records of church growth being broken here in a period of 150 years. Nevertheless, a very significant period, because it kind of laid down some quite deep roots of what was to continue to be quite an influence. After a while, the Dutch began to import certain slave people from the East Indies to work on the farms. There was some contact with the indigenous people, the Khoi people, Khoi Khoi. And the interaction between these three groups, the Dutch, the slave, the Khoi, actually generated a number of things. It generated a new language, the Afrikaans language, which was rather derisively called for many years, Kombase Hollands. because that's where it started. It was in the interaction of working with people who had limited vocabulary. It also produced the Cape Coloured community, which is a very significant community in South Africa today, particularly in the Cape. And their roots are precisely in all those areas. The Khoi people, the Dutch people, the slave people. Amalgamating together to become what was to become the so-called coloured people. In this period, as I say, religious activity was restricted, and the first missionary to arrive here was George Schmidt, a Moravian missionary, 1737. Now, it doesn't mean that no outreach was made at all. There was a lady, a Khoi lady by the name of Eva, who was baptized by one of the very first preachers or ministers, and she actually married the surgeon of the settlement. But it was very rare. It was very little. Quite frankly, the early ministers who came here to minister to the Dutch East India Company employees had their hands pretty full with just doing that. It wasn't a lie. Although it was the golden age of the Netherlands and some quite significant things were happening in the spiritual life, you must remember that the people who came here were not like the pilgrim immigrants to America. The pilgrim immigrants to America went there for religious purposes, for religious freedom. The Dutch who came here came for only one reason, commercial reasons. However, they were part of the Dutch Reformed Church. They were obliged by law to go to church every Sunday. There were penalties if they didn't. First penalty of one Sunday missing was a cut in the wine ration. Penalty for missing two Sundays was, I can't forget, but if you missed three Sundays, you were put in prison. So you went to church. But that was not unusual. The same thing was happening in England. It was a criminal offense not to go to church. That's why people like John Bunyan in the 17th century landed up in prison for 12 years because he didn't go to the right church. So we must always understand things in their cultural context. So it's almost surprising that George Schmidt was allowed to come to the Cape. In fact, he was invited. I think there were some members of the Dutch Reformed Church in Amsterdam that were interested in the Khoi people here and interviewed George Schmidt and sent him here. The ministers here, there was only a few, one or two of them, were a little bit suspicious. You know, there was this great suspicion of what may be sectarian. And he assured them, they asked him, are you going to baptize people? And he quoted 1 Corinthians and he said, Christ sent me not to baptize, but to preach the gospel. So he began his work among the Khoi people and slowly and steadily. And eventually he developed a group of disciples. They were working out in what was called then Baviaans Kloof, later on renamed Genadendal. And it came to the point where actually he needed to baptize some of his followers. And he consulted with Zinzendorf back in Herrenhut. And Zinzendorf kind of ordained him through the post and said, go ahead, we ordain you and you must baptize the people. But when knowledge of this got to the clergy at Cape Town, they were very unhappy. This is irregular. This can't be done. And in fact, they mobilized that George Schmidt must be sent back to Europe. So it's very sad, but you've got to understand that in the context of their time. So it was nearly 50 years before the Moravians were allowed to come back again. The Moravians weren't the only people under suspicion. There were some German Lutherans in that early settlement, and they wanted a Lutheran church. But the Cape authorities said, no, you can't have such confusion. Two churches in one area. Little did they know what was going to happen in this country. But for them at that point, the idea, you're just going to confuse everybody. There can only be one church, one denomination in one place. But the Germans continued to persist, you know. And there was a German businessman by the name of Martin Melk. And in 1774, he built a warehouse in Cape Town. It looked, people thought, a bit like a church. But he said it was a warehouse. And actually, he turned it into a church. And in fact, it's the oldest ecclesiastical building. It's still standing there in Cape Town, and you can see it. And make a point of going to see it if you go. The original German Lutheran church there. Finally, in 1778, permission came from Amsterdam for the Lutherans to have their own church, and they called their own pastor. And then they had other problems because they tried to regulate everything. What happens if a Lutheran marries a Dutch Reformed? Well, they said, all right, if a Lutheran marries a Dutch Reformed, the boys will be baptized into the Reformed church and the girls into the Lutheran church. That'll sort it out. Until the Lutheran pastor began to, you know, baptize the boys too, and that caused complexities, etc. But that sounds a little negative. We must take note of some bright sparks. In 1786, a minister was called to a church in Cape Town by the name of Helperus Ritsema van Leer, a man of deep spiritual passion and conviction. In fact, he has sometimes been called the Jonathan Edwards of Cape Town. And he was part of that Nadere Reformatie, that kind of Puritan revival movement in Holland. And his very first sermon here was from 1 Corinthians 2:2. I resolve to know nothing while with you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. He immediately began to awaken the people to the spiritual needs of the slaves and the Khoi people. And he began to make efforts to instruct them and teach them and reach them with the gospel. And his work actually brought about quite a change of the spiritual atmosphere in the Cape Colony and a real concern for the spiritual needs of people like the Khoi and the slaves. Following him with very much the same spirit, but a man born in the Cape, was Michiel Christian Vos. He returned in 1794 to the Cape as a minister of the church. And he also preached in his inaugural sermon from Mark 16, go into all the world and preach the good news to all creation. And he announced his intention to preach to the slaves and the Khoi Khoi and initiated quite a big work. With this change of atmosphere, the Moravians were advised, things have changed in the Cape. Why don't you renew your application to send some missionaries there? Which they did, and they were successful. So in 1792, three German Moravian missionaries landed in the Cape, Marsfeld, Schwinn, and Kuno. And they made their way to where Schmidt had been working nearly 50 years before. And to their amazement, they found one of his converts whom he had baptized. She was now an old lady, Lena, 80 years old. And she still had the original Dutch New Testament that George Schmidt had given her. And her eyesight wasn't too good, but she had taught one of her children or grandchildren to read it, and they were able to read it in the original, in the Dutch. Now, with the reestablishment of the Moravian mission, there was great blessing. And in a very quick time, the community at Baviaans Kloof grew into quite a vital, praising, worshiping Christian community. In fact, the governor then decided Baviaans Kloof, Baboons Kloof, is not a good name for the place. Let's rename it Genadendal, Valley of Grace. Well, there's not much more than can be said about the Dutch period. We've covered 150 years. The British period is 1800 to 1910. Approximately 1800. It's actually confused. It was the time of the Napoleonic Wars, and the British originally occupied the Cape to make sure that Napoleon wouldn't use it. After Napoleon was put in prison, they gave it back to the Dutch. Then Napoleon jumped prison and started the war all over again, and then the British occupied it again. And then eventually they made a cash offer to the Dutch government or to the Dutch East India Company, I'm not sure, and they bought it straight. So we compress all of that into the year, let's say, 1800. from about 1800, control of the Cape colony passed into the hands of the British. Now, this was to be a time of accelerated growth, economically, politically, militarily, and religiously. The British obviously had enormous more resources than the Dutch did. In fact, this was the height of the British Empire, and the British were, you know, expanding on all sides. It was during this time that other denominational streams entered into the Cape. Anglicans, Methodists, Roman Catholics, Presbyterians, Congregationalists, Baptists, and some smaller bodies as well. Now, remember I mentioned that the 19th century is sometimes been called the great century of Protestant missions. Now, it's exactly the 19th century that is the British period. And the British had, as far as that went, quite an enlightened policy of granting great freedom for missionaries to enter in. And large numbers of missionaries came here. The London Missionary Society sent missionaries, the Moravians, the Wesleyan Missionary Society, the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions, various Lutheran missionary societies, Reformed and Catholic missionary societies, all came to the Cape in this period. They came from Britain and America, from Germany, from France, from Switzerland, from Norway, from Sweden, and other parts of the world. No wonder we've got such an incredible variety. And I mean, even in one missionary, you know, even among the Lutherans, the Norwegian Lutherans and the German Lutherans didn't, you know, they produced separate churches because they had their own style. Just interacting with the political military side, it was during this period, the British period, that the British authorities engaged in major wars against everyone. They first were engaged in a whole lot of wars on the eastern border with the Xhosa people and eventually subjugated them so that the Eastern Cape became kind of incorporated into the Cape Colony. They colonized Natal, which of course brought them into conflict with the Zulu people. And there were quite a significant number of wars against the Zulu people, which meant that the whole of the Natal area became eventually incorporated into the British colony. And we're going to look at the Great Trek, but eventually they engaged in significant wars with the Boer people, the Afrikaners. And that resulted in the Boer republics of the Transvaal and the Free State being incorporated. So at the end of all of these wars, we actually have a South Africa with its prison boundaries. So basically, the British created the present South Africa as far as its boundaries go. The boundaries of South Africa today came into being during the British period and as a result of the various conflicts that they had. Now, the result of immigration and missionary work, as I've said, resulted in very significant church growth. Very significant church growth on all sides. For 150 years, there was only one church here, the Dutch Reformed Church, and they expanded from 1 to 7 congregations. Suddenly now you're getting Anglicans, Methodists, Congregationalists, Presbyterians, Baptists, Lutherans, and other groups. And divisions are occurring. The Anglicans split into two groups, the Church of the Province and the Church of England in South Africa. The Dutch Reform split into three groups, the Drie Sisterkerke. We'll take a look at that a bit more later. Several Lutheran churches. But now, a further complication was with white dominance. It was inevitable that certain African Christians would want their independence. They couldn't get political independence, but one way they could get independence was ecclesiastical independence. So towards the end of the British period, you're beginning to find the start of African independent churches. It began as a small trickle. It was to become a mighty flood in the 20th century. Now, that's just the overview. Let's just go into a little bit more detail quickly, though. One of the first missionary societies that worked extensively here was the London Missionary Society. It was set up in 1795 in England. And it sent out people, in 1799, four LMS missionaries arrived. Kishere, Edwards, Edmonds, and Van der Kemp. Van der Kemp was actually a Dutchman, but he came through the London Missionary Society. Many more later were to come through this missionary society. People like Robert Moffat, David Livingston, and others. Van der Kemp had a great burden to try and reach the Xhosa people. But it was very difficult because there was continual conflict on the border. There was one war after the other. And he actually didn't really have much success. However, interestingly, there was one Xhosa herd boy who heard Van der Kemp. And although he didn't hear him again or any other missionary, something stuck. His name was Ntsikana, who is sometimes called the morning star of the Xhosa church. He retained something, and in about 1815, he had a dramatic experience that was to change the course of his life. He began to preach a very simple message about the greatness of God and the coming of Jesus to bring forgiveness through his blood. He didn't have a developed theology. He had no one to teach it to him. He had a very simple group. He rang his bell. He sang his song. He taught the people. But the missionaries who came there later were amazed to find actually how much of the gospel he had managed to pass on. The Anglicans came, and their first bishop was a man called Robert Gray, who happened to be a man of very high church sympathies, Anglo-Catholic. This caused tensions among the Anglicans, which have continued to this day, because some of the more evangelical Anglicans didn't like Robert Gray. And when Robert Gray formed the Church of the Province in South Africa, some of the evangelicals said, "We don't want to be part of that. We are the continuing Church of England in South Africa." And that is why they continue to be to this day these two bodies. The Church of England recently renamed itself REACH, the Reformed Evangelical Anglican Church. The Methodists came in early. Now, in those days, the Methodists were the cutting edge of spiritual zeal. Remember, the Great Awakening in England in the 18th century produced Methodism in various forms. And Methodism for 100 years was imbued with a tremendous spiritual zeal, missionary zeal, evangelistic zeal. And indeed, some of the finest early work was done actually by the Methodists. There's this testimony of a soldier, I think Kendrick. In 1809, there was an earthquake in the Cape, and this sparked off a religious concern. And he wrote, "The spark of grace soon began to catch from soul to soul. Prayer meetings now commenced among them, and such a cry for mercy followed as is most wonderful. The room frequently has been so crowded that many have been unable to reach the door." Now, the Methodists wanted a minister, and a minister came from England. But you must remember, in those days, this is 1816, feelings between Anglicans and Methodists were still quite strong. In the view of Anglicans, Methodists are dissidents. They're Methodists, and that says enough. So when the first Methodist minister came to the Cape, the British governor, who was a staunch Anglican, sent him packing. "You can't minister here." In 1816, another Methodist minister came, Barnabas Shaw, who was also refused permission to minister. Now, this is now under the British authorities, but he ignored it and he carried on ministering anyway. So he actually was the first Methodist minister. One of the most outstanding early Methodist ministers was William Shaw, no relative of Barnabas Shaw. He arrived in 1820 with the British settlers, and he was a man with a tremendous vision. He came originally to minister to, you know, the white English settlers, But right from the beginning, he made it very clear. I've got a much bigger vision. He dreamed of establishing a chain of mission stations all down the coast from the eastern province all the way to Natal. And to a remarkable extent, he succeeded. I mean, listen to just some of these mission stations that later on became towns, and some of them you'll recognize their names. Wesleyville in 1823, Mount Coke in 1825, Butterworth in 1827, Morley in 1829, Clarkbury in 1830, Buntingville in 1830. This was the product of the missionary zeal of this William Shaw, who seemed to be a man of deep Christian faith. And he ministered to everybody. He ministered to the English Methodists. He ministered even to the Dutch Reformed people when they didn't have their own minister. And he had this burden. It wasn't easy. Remember, that was a time where there was great turmoil in those border areas. There was often conflict. There were wars. Some of these mission stations were burnt to the ground and people killed. But patiently, they would go back and just build them again. It's interesting that the church that Nelson Mandela grew up in the same area, was a Methodist church. And that was part of the product of those early Methodist missionaries. The Presbyterians made their appearance in South Africa. The first Presbyterians was a group of Scottish soldiers in Cape, and they formed a Calvinistic society in 1806, in which they met for Bible study and prayer. In 1812, they persuaded George Tom, who was a London Missionary Society missionary, to be their minister. And it was he who formed the first Presbyterian church in Southern Africa. I think it's St. Andrew's in the Cape, somewhere there. The Presbyterians founded a very significant college, which was originally Lovedale. It was founded as a mission of the Glasgow Missionary Society in 1824. And it proved to be an area, a place where many of the early African leaders, political and other, gained their things. Lovedale afterwards changed its name, and it's a university today. Can anybody remember what is the name of that university? Fort Hare, that's it, thank you. Fort Hare. It eventually evolved and became the present. Again, if I remember correctly, that's where Nelson Mandela went. So we can see, am I right? I think so, yes. So we see the influence of early missionary institutions in shaping quite a few things, including some of the future political leaders. The very first black man to be officially ordained into the Christian ministry was a Presbyterian, Tiyo Soga. In the days when Tsikana, remember Tsikana was preaching to Ngika, the Xhosa chief, he sent one of his counselors called Soga to listen to him. And Soga was very impressed, and although he was never baptized, most of his children were converted to Christianity, and Tiyo Soga was one of them. Seventh child of his chief wife, Nosutu, a devout believer who encouraged her children to study. Tiyo actually went to Scotland, where he was baptized in 1848, and he returned to work in South Africa. He worked as an interpreter, but he went back to Scotland to study theology, and he went through the full rigorous Presbyterian course of studies, and there he also met a Presbyterian lass and married her. So when he came back with a Scottish wife. He was the first man, he wrote many hymns, and he was the first man to translate Pilgrim's Progress into Xhosa. Just as a byproduct of history, I just mentioned little things. A very tragic event happened among the Xhosa people at this time. Event which is known in history as the cattle killing tragedy. And tragically and sadly, it occurred in a time when there was actually a great spiritual revival. Maybe that reminds us that the powers of evil and the powers of the Holy Spirit are always working together and with great power. Now, what was this all about? Politically, you must remember the Xhosa people were in a difficult position. There was the pressure from the British, sort of from the south. And then there was the pressure of the Zulus under the great Zulu chief, Shaka, and the militant Zulus. And they were kind of caught in a pincer. And they just saw themselves losing ground, losing everything. And this led to demoralization. And in 1856, a young girl, Nongqawuse, claimed to hear voices declaring apocalyptic events that would bring about a radical change, a total defeat of the whites, and the restoration of the Xhosa people. But for this to happen, the people must have faith. And the people must make a great act of sacrifice to the ancestors for them to bring about this great reversal. And that sacrifice was this. They must slaughter all their livestock, destroy all their grain, everything. And only when they had made this great sacrifice, then the cattle would come from under the ground and the grain would come and there would be a golden age for the Xhosa people. Now, Nongqawuse's uncle, Mahlakaza, was a renowned seer and he supported her. And they began to do this. She designated the 18th of February, 1857, as the day of deliverance and restoration. Well, it didn't happen. And when the day came, there were no livestock. There was no grain. There was tragedy. There was starvation. And there was mass impoverishment. It was one of the greatest blows that the Xhosa people experienced. That's just a kind of one of the... We're living in an area of a time of tragedy, growth, conflict, and all sorts of things. The Baptists also arrived in South Africa with the 1820 settlers. They were only a few in number, but under the leadership of William Miller, he began holding services under a tree in the Albany district. The Baptists were augmented in number in 1857, when about 2,400 German soldiers arrived. Now, why were they doing here? Well, they had been fighting for the British in the Crimean War. And as a reward for their good service, the British said, "We'll give you some land in South Africa." And among those soldiers were some German Baptists, staunch German Baptists. And they quickly gathered together to form a Baptist church, and they wrote back to Johann Onken. Onken was the great German Baptist leader, sometimes being called the Apostle of the Baptists. He did an amazing work in Germany all the way into Russia. And so they sent him a letter describing the kind of minister that they wanted. Onken wrote back and said, "You, such men do not grow on trees, you know." I would try and imitate a German accent, but I won't bother. But eventually he sent them a man who was his personal assistant, Hugo Gutscher, who must stand out as one of the truly outstanding, devoted Baptist ministers that have worked in this country. So effective was the work of Hugo Gutscher that when the Baptist Union was officially established in 1877, there were more German-speaking Baptists than English-speaking Baptists. Interesting thought at that point. One of the people baptized by Hugo Gutscher was Johann Urdendahl, an Afrikaans farmer who had studied for the ministry in the Engie Kerk, became a bit disillusioned about some things, was a very sincere man, and he heard about this German Baptist. So he made his way all the way to meet Hugo Gutscher, who baptized him. And Urdendahl came back, and that was the beginning of the Afrikaanse Baptiste Kerk in South Africa. Another group of Baptists came from an interesting place, India. Now, within the Natal colony, the British began to develop the sugarcane industry. They found to their disappointment that the Zulus were not too keen to work for them. So they were casting around, you know, where can we get people to work in the sugarcanes? And, of course, India was part of the British Empire. So a whole lot of Indians came, not as slaves, but as indentured laborers. I think that means they signed a contract to work so many years, after which they had the choice to go back to India if they wanted to, or they could stay. Very few of them went back to India. But anyway, among these Indians, the overwhelming majority, of course, would have been Hindus. But some of them were Telugu Baptists, because God had done a remarkable work in the Telugu people through the Baptist missionary. And these Telugu Baptists stuck together, and they wrote back home to say, please send us a minister, which they did. So all the way from India, John Rangia came and exercised a powerful ministry. In fact, his first convert, interestingly, was a man who had been arrested for murder and condemned to death. And I think he was a Hindu, but he was an Indian. And they asked him, can you go and speak to this man? And he spoke to the man, and the Lord melted his heart, and he became a Christian. They didn't commute his death sentence, and John Rangia was holding his hand just before he was hanged. And the last words of the man was, I go to the Lord Jesus. So we see from different countries, different places, different people coming. Obviously, a massive church like the Roman Catholic Church would have sent missionaries. And they had the same freedom as anybody else under the British government. I'm not going to spend a great deal of time. I can mention just one man who was quite an extraordinary man. He was an Austrian man, Franz Pfanner. And he initially was turned down for missionary work because he was considered too weak. But he persevered. And this is his testimony. I'd like you just to listen to it. He said, from the beginning, his heart was inclined to missionary work. Quote, as often as I recited the verse in the Miserere, that's Psalm 53, prescribed in our rule for daily recitation, I will teach the unjust thy ways, and the wicked will be converted to thee. Close quote. The yearning and desire to work in the badly neglected missions tormented me and gave me no rest, he wrote in his memoirs. Now, he eventually landed up founding the Marian Hill Monastery just outside Pinetown, I think it is, in Natal. And it was very successful indeed. By 1898, with a community of 285 monks, Marian Hill had become the largest abbey in the world and the center of quite a number of extensions to other areas. Let's go back to the London Missionary Society. One of the most extraordinary missionaries was Robert Moffat from Scotland. Astonishing number of missionaries here came from Scotland. He worked among the Tswana people. He settled down in Kuruman. He worked hard. He worked hard at translating. He learned the Tswana language. He translated the Bible into the Tswana language. But it was very difficult. Only in 1829, he experienced a spiritual breakthrough. And I quote from Duplessis' book. Without any apparent antecedent agency, a wave of strong emotion broke over the inhabitants. They crowded the place of worship long before the service was time to begin. Men, women, and children were bathed in tears. Some would listen with intense earnestness to the tones of the preacher's voice, then suddenly fall down in hysterics or suffer themselves to be borne away in a state of extreme prostration. At all hours of the day, the missionaries would be beset in their homes by numbers of anxious seekers after salvation. Those who had found peace would gather for prayer and praise. And early morning and late, even, the voices of rejoicing and salvation was heard in the tabernacles of the righteous. Well, that was obviously a divine breakthrough. A divine breakthrough after many, many years of heartbreaking and very difficult labor and effort in every area. Another little interesting historical point is Moffat developed a fascinating friendship with Mzilikats. Mzilikats was one of Shaka's generals who fell out of favor with Shaka, so he had to run. If you weren't in Shaka's favor, you got as far from him as you could. So Mzilikats moved all the way from Natal up to this part of the world, in the old Transvaal. And while he was, that's not so far, we're not so far from Botswana. So Moffat actually developed a friendship with him. He visited him. He he never had the satisfaction of seeing him converted. Mzilikats, unfortunately, was addicted to alcohol, and he eventually also, we'll see later, was defeated by the Boers and had to run up to Bulawayo, where he established the Indibele Kingdom in what is now Zimbabwe. And even in Zimbabwe, Moffat went to visit him at one time. As I said, he translated the entire Bible into Tswana, and he spent some time in England to see it through the press. It was then that David Livingstone heard him speak. Moffat was speaking once, and he said, on a morning, I can get up, and on a clear day, I can see the smoke of 1,000 fires going up as people, the women, are preparing the meal, and none of them have heard the gospel. And that was when Livingstone felt his call to come to Africa. And Livingstone actually married Moffat's daughter. I'm not sure if it was the best decision. Livingstone was a man who shouldn't have married anybody because he was too much on the move all the time. In fact, Livingstone, although he's one of the most famous of the missionaries, in many ways was a failure. His preaching produced very few converts. He lamented the neglect of his family. He clashed with his fellow missionaries. The Zambezi expedition he led and the university mission he inspired were failures. But there was something about his indomitable spirit. Livingstone had this vision of the gospel penetrating into Africa. And not only the gospel, but even commerce and development, so that the people of Africa can be set free from the powers of darkness enslaving them and can enter into the light of the gospel. He worked hard against slavery. In fact, it was through his influence that the Sultan of Zanzibar was threatened with a naval blockade if he did not close his slave market forever. Livingstone eventually died in the heart of Africa. I think it was in the northern part of Zambia, my country. And just as an indication of the intense loyalty of those who did know him and love him and were influenced by him, he had two African friends who, when he died, they took his heart out and buried it under a tree because his heart must stay in Africa. And then they carried his body all the way. Now, can you imagine this? They carried his body all the way from northern Zambia to what is today Maputo, Lorenzo Marx, so that he could be shipped all the way back to England. He does remain an inspiration of missions, although in his actual work there were defects. In the neglect of his family there were defects. He was a man with faults. Many do. Luther had faults. Wesley had faults. They all had faults. But they were servants of God. Now, during this British period, as I say, there were wars, there were movements, there were demographic things. One of the major demographic movements was actually the Great Trek between 1835 and 1840. There were about 15,000 Afrikaners in the Eastern Cape who were not happy under British rule. And I won't go into all the reasons, but eventually they heard that there were vast open places in the central part of the country. Temporarily, there may have been, actually, because Chaka's impis had done raiding there and, quite frankly, scattered everybody. Anyway, their dream and their thought was, we will go and establish an independent country of our own, which we can govern by our own laws and own rules in the interior. So that was the Groot Trek that moved thousands of Afrikaners. Some of them moved to Natal, but when the British annexed Natal, they went back over the Drakensberg again, and they established the two Boer republics of the South African Republic, the Transvaal, which we will call, and the Free State, eventually. Now, an interesting little interaction here. Daniel Lindley was an American, son of a Presbyterian missionary, a minister. He was born in 1801 in Pennsylvania, and he felt a call to missionary service and was sent to South Africa to work among the Zulus by the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missionaries, the ABM. He arrived in Cape Town. He went up and he was assigned to go to Mzilikazi's people up hereabouts. I'm not quite sure of the area exactly. But hardly had he begun there when the Boers arrived and there was a great big fight, and Mzilikazi had to flee over the, well, I say the border, there wasn't a border, but to Bulawayo. And so suddenly Daniel Lindley found himself without a congregation. And the Boers said to him, well, we don't have a minister. Will you be our minister? We're going back to Natal. And he said, I need to go back to Natal. I'll be your minister. And coming from a, you know, Presbyterian and Reformed, or essentially the same doctrine, the man had a big enough heart to minister to anybody who wanted to be ministered to. I'm not quite sure in what language he ministered to. Maybe he picked up Afrikaans quickly. But he became a very beloved minister. And in fact, he played a very significant role in the establishment of the Dutch Reformed churches in the Transvaal. In fact, the little town of Lindley, you pass by it, don't you, on the way to, was named after Daniel Lindley. Interesting. And by the Boers. When he eventually got back to Natal, after ministering to the Afrikaners for quite a few years, he went back to Zulu missions. And in many ways, we see in Lindley a remarkable manifestation of a Christian spirit. He was a man who could become a Boer to the Boers, a Zulu to the Zulus, in fact, anything to anybody, because he had an apostolic spirit of wanting to proclaim the gospel. It was in the Transvaal that the one Dutch Reformed Church kind of became three. Initially, when the Trekkers left to establish an independent Boer Republic, the Cape Synod wasn't sympathetic. In fact, they wouldn't even give them a minister. They thought that this was a bit stupid. So the Trekkers had to make use actually of a missionary of all people, to be their minister, a man by the name of Smit. And when they set up a church, they decided that they would set up an independent church, not necessarily connected to the Cape Synod. And that became the Hervormde Church. Nederduitse Hervormde Church. There were some folk in the Hervormde Church who were not quite happy, who were strict doppers, you know, more strictly confessional, reformed. They didn't like this business of singing hymns. They thought psalms is what you sing in church. And they actually eventually broke away to form the Gereformeerdes. And then there was yet another group that felt, actually, we want to retain our links with the original Cape Synod. So actually, the Drie Sisterkerke had their origin right here in the old Transvaal, where you had the Hervormers and the Ingeë Mense and the Gereformeerde Mense, the Doppers. For English-speaking people, it's totally confusing, because the translation of all of those things is just Reformed. You know, Hervormed is Reformed, Gereformeerde is Reformed. But if you understand Afrikaans, you can see the distinctions. Let's look at one of the Dutch Reformed people who, in my opinion, is perhaps the greatest Christian leader, or one of them at least, that this country has produced, Andrew Murray. Andrew Murray's father was a Scotsman. When the Dutch Reformed churches were needing ministers, the natural place to get them was Holland. But the trouble was is that the Dutch churches at that time were deeply influenced by liberal trends. And the more conservative Dutch Reformed churches here were not happy with the kind of ministers that were coming. But somebody told them, you can get better ministers from Scotland. They're more conservative. They're more reformed. They're more confessional. So a man was sent, George Tom, I think it was, one of the London LMS missionaries. And he went and got a whole lot of missionaries or ministers from Scotland. That's why so many Afrikaner families have got English surnames like Murray and other things like that, even though they're 100% Afrikaans. Because Andrew Murray Sr. was one of those Scottish ministers who came and he worked, where was his church? Graafrenet, does he? And that's where Andrew Murray Jr. grew up. As a youngster, he was sent to Scotland for education. Later on, when he and his brother John indicated a call to the ministry, they sent them to Holland to learn Dutch so that they could actually minister in Dutch churches. And eventually, he came back here. His name is honored in quite widely circles, Reformed circles, Anglican, Methodist, Baptist, Pentecostal, and Charismatic. He eventually wrote something like 250 books, published in Dutch, English, and Afrikaans. Some of them published in up to 15 languages. He tried to amalgamate his Reformed heritage, which he genuinely respected and never abandoned, with what was those days the current sort of hot trends of Christianity, the holiness movement and the healing movement. He made some mistakes, but there's no doubt about it that he had a heart for God. In 1860, he accepted a call to the church in Worcester, where he served for 4 years. And it was while he was there that a number of Cape churches, including Worcester, experienced a remarkable religious revival. Now, I just want to quickly come back to you, thinking to Tim's question. You know, revivals are extraordinary things in that they just seem to move everywhere. This revival actually had its beginnings in Canada in 1857. It moved quickly to a Dutch Reformed church in New York, known as the Prayer Meeting Revival. It spread rapidly in 1858 throughout America, producing something like 1 million converts. It jumped across the Atlantic with extraordinary results in United Kingdom, particularly Wales and North Ireland. I read a book just recently by a contemporary about the amazing movement in Wales. And as far away as South Africa, people heard about it. And Andrew Murray organized a conference to give news about the amazing things they were hearing about in America and Ulster and Ireland, and to pray that God may visit the churches in South Africa. Well, it was a wonderful conference. They went back home, and let me pick up the story here. One Sunday evening at nearby Worcester, 60 young people were gathered in a hall in a prayer meeting led by Jesse de Vries, an assistant of Andrew Murray. Several had risen to announce the singing of a hymn and to offer prayer. So it was quite a formal prayer meeting. Remember, this is Dutch Reformed. And you put up your hand, you ask permission, you announce a hymn, you offer a prayer. When a Fingo girl, now a Fingo was a branch of the Xhosa people who had become a little bit closer to the Europeans. She put up her hand very shyly and asked, could she pray? Permission granted. After hesitation, I suppose de Vries was thinking, is dit reg? Hier die Fingo meisie. But he decided, let me give her a chance. Let me give her a chance to pray. And de Vries reported that while she was praying, a sound like that of approaching thunder was heard, coming closer and closer until it enveloped the hall, shaking the place. The company burst into prayer, a majority audibly, a minority in murmuring tones. Andrew Murray had just finished his evening services, and hearing of something unusual, he hurried over to the hall to investigate. Finding everyone engaged in simultaneous prayer, he tried without success to quiet them. Disturbed by the apparent confusion, he departed saying, God is a God of order, but here everything is confusion. It was some time before Murray was convinced of the divine nature of the visitation. But in the following week, Murray himself was leading a prayer meeting in the school when the same mysterious roll of approaching thunder was heard, followed by an outburst of simultaneous prayer. Now, these things are carefully recorded by reliable historians like Edwin Orr and others, and there's no doubt about it. And they made a powerful impact. The revival influenced many other places, Calvinia and, you know, all those little towns in the Eastern Cape. It also influenced the Methodist mission stations in KwaZulu-Natal, what is today KwaZulu-Natal. And Many, many, as a result of that revival, were not only converted, but offered themselves as for work in as a minister or missions. There was extraordinary fruit of that revival. And the interesting thing is, Andrew Murray, who had been praying all his life for revival, was shocked by it, tried to stop it, because it was extraordinary. He thought, this isn't orderly. Blaze still, mense, ek is jou dominee, gestuur deur God. Nobody blaze still. God is a God of all. He tried to get them to sing a song. Nobody was interested. They just were on their faces praying. But then a man at the door said to him, Dominee, I must just tell you, I've come from America. This is of God. Don't try and stop it. Don't try and stop it. This is the work of God. And so he came to believe and entered into the experience himself. There were many influenced at that time. One of the very first black South African to be ordained to the Methodist ministry was Charles Pumla, an amazing man. He was born in Butterworth in the Eastern Cape in 1834 to parents who had only recently become Christians. He grew up in a Christian home. While watching over his father's sheep, he studied his Bible and practiced preaching to the trees. He became involved in a great American, I forget his name, Taylor. Taylor, there was a great American Methodist, Bishop Taylor, who preached all over the world with extraordinary results. And when Bishop Taylor, yeah. And when he was in South Africa, Pumla acted as his interpreter and later on became a powerful preacher on his own. Now, despite revival, doesn't mean everything's fine. You know, two things can happen very quickly. I mentioned the great revival in America, which was one of the greatest revivals they ever had in 1859. What happened to America just a few years after that? Civil War. When was the Civil War? 1860-something? There we are. Which was the most devastating judgment in all America's history, with vast numbers of people killed. This is history. We don't understand it. But God is working, God is judging, Satan is working, and man is in the middle of it all. But even while the Dutch Reformed churches were revived, there was a strong attack from liberal elements, especially those ministers who had studied in the Netherlands. And there were some very capable people. There was a Dominee Kotze of Darlington. There was a Dominee Burger of somewhere else. Dominee Burger later on became the president of the Transvaal Republic. And they challenged the traditional Reformed orthodoxy of the Dutch Reformed Church. They were disciplined by the church. They appealed to the secular authorities. The secular authorities upheld their case. The church appealed again. And Andrew Murray was delegated to go all the way to the Privy Council in England, which is the Supreme Court, to argue the case. Actually, he lost, although it is said he argued a brilliant case. But what that did to the Dutch Reformed Church is basically say, enough of getting ministers from the Netherlands. We're going to build our own seminary and we're going to control it. And that's why Stellenbosch Seminary was built. And for many years, it was a bastion, actually, of Orthodox Christian Reformed theology. Unfortunately, I don't think that can be said anymore, sadly. But for many years, and it played a major role in maintaining within Dutch Reformed circles a form, at least, of Orthodox Christian theology. The Dutch Reformed people weren't the only people to have this struggle. The Anglicans had a tremendous battle with Bishop Colenso. Bishop Colenso was a very capable young man. He was appointed by the Anglican Church to be a missionary to the Zulus, and they made him a bishop. There in Natal, he built a press. He was a man of extraordinary abilities. But he'd been influenced by liberal circles, and he published a book on on Romans that was shaky in doctrine. And eventually he was asked by the archbishop to hold it. But he proceeded to publish in 1862 the Old Testament, the Pentateuch and the book of Joshua, critically examined. Convinced on the grounds of its bad arithmetic, Colenso was brilliant at arithmetic, and that the Old Testament could not possibly be verbally inerrant. Colenso concluded that it was no more inspired than the words of Cicero, Lactantius, and the Sikh gurus. Well, that led to a tremendous battle in the Anglican Church, in which they had to discipline him. And he eventually was kind of disciplined and kicked out of the church. But just to show you, these things are not new. We are battling these same battles today. Towards the end of the British period, we have the beginning of African independent churches. They were first known as Ethiopian churches. The first church was Ibandla Las Ethiopia, established by Mangena Mokone in 1892. Well, let's move on. Our time is moving, and I want to leave you some chance for some questions. We're going to come to the third period, 1910 to 1994. This really was brought about by another tragic era in our history. We've got a lot of them. The Second Anglo-Boer War. When the Boers established their republic in the old Transvaal, they thought they would be left in peace. They probably would have been, except for one thing, gold. When gold was discovered, and how much of it was discovered, suddenly they realized they've got the most gold in the world. And Cecil John Rhodes, who was the premier of the Cape at that time, I have a feeling he thought, this is ridiculous, that all this gold should land up in the hands of these primitive farmers. The British should be in control of this. So sooner or later, he wangled it that way, and it led to a most tragic war, the Anglo-Boer War of 1899 to 1902, the longest, costliest, and bloodiest, and most humiliating war for Britain between 1815 and 1915. 22,000 British soldiers were killed, 34,000 Boer people, 15,000 black lives died. But worse than the deaths, it left a legacy of bitterness that was to stoke the fires of Afrikaner nationalism and sow the seeds of further racial strife. And its long shadow was to reach to the end of the 20th century. The Boer War, the Anglo-Boer War, was indeed, it was an unjust war. And it was a war that led to terrible suffering, because when the British won the major battles, the Boers didn't want to give up, so they resorted to guerrilla warfare. And then the British began a campaign of burning down their farms and taking the women and children into concentration camps. They weren't accustomed to living in conditions like that. Disease broke out. Many of them died. It was tragedy from the beginning to the end. And it's no wonder that out of that tragedy rose these tremendous feelings. But again, isn't this the strange thing of history? Let me show you a marvelous thing that occurred right in that Boer War. As the British began to capture Boer soldiers, they sent them to prison of war camps. Now, they didn't want to put them in South Africa in case they broke out, and then they would just go back and carry on fighting. So they sent them to prison of war camps all over the world. I mean, Bermuda and St. Helena and India and Ceylon, wherever the British Empire was, were these groups of Boer soldiers gathered together as prisoners of war. And the British did permit chaplains, dominies, to go along with them. And there in the camps broke out some extraordinary spiritual revivals. Now, I've spoken to some of my Afrikaner friends who don't even know about this. I think many of them do, but an astonishing amount don't. And there, and simultaneously all over the place, in St. Helena, in Ceylon, in India, you had these Astonishing spiritual movements, remarkable religious awakenings occurred in these camps that deeply influenced the lives of many individual prisoners and had an impact on the subsequent religious and social history of South Africa. Now, just another interesting point. What's the date? 1906. What's happening in 1906? Revival. The Welsh Revival. The Korean Revival. Revival in India. In other words, that was a time of divine visitation. That was a time where all over the world, not just in Wales or Korea, but where in many different places, God was pouring out his spirit in an unusual way. And even in these prisoner of war camps scattered all over the world, simultaneously. Doesn't that tell us something about the nature of genuine revival? Well, I must move on fast now because I've got to move. I'm going to have to leave some things out. But I want to say something about now the beginnings of Amazioni and the beginnings of South African Pentecostalism, which plays a major role, of a significant role in this country. Just to back up a little bit, there was an unusual Scotsman, another one, John Alexander Dowie. He grew up Presbyterian. He became Congregational. He went to Australia. He eventually moved from Australia to America. He's one of the more eccentric products of the holiness movement. And he actually set up near, what's the city? Zion City. It's near Chicago, I think, maybe. And he set up Zion City, USA. Zion City, in which there was no alcohol, no pork, no smoking, and everybody had to live strictly holy lives. He was an advocate of the holiness movement. He became later on quite eccentric, but he had a massive influence. He published a little newspaper called The Leaves of Healing. And this newspaper spread all over the world, containing testimonies of healing. He was part of the holiness healing movement, the movement that Andrew Murray actually was very much influenced by, but in a much more moderate way. And many people picked up these magazines and right here. And in fact, one of them was Peter Leroux, a Dutch Reformed missionary who was a personal disciple of Andrew Murray. And in fact, when he was ordained as a missionary in Wakkerstroom, Andrew Murray came down to attend it. He was a favorite student of Andrew Murray. But Pierre Leroux began reading Dowie's Leaves of Healing and became more and more convinced of the holiness message, more and more strongly. Other people also, people like Edgar Mahon, many Baptists have got connection there, others as well. In 1901, the DRC Missionary Commission found Leroux guilty of rejecting doctors and medicines, pork, tobacco, and infant baptism. Well, that's enough to excommunicate anybody, I reckon. And so his career in the Dutch Reformed Church ended, and he just called his church Zion Church. But now, in 1904, Dowie sent one of his missionaries to South Africa, Daniel Bryant, having commissioned him as overseer of the church that he had founded, which was called the Christian Catholic Church in Zion. That was Dowie's church in Zion City, USA, the Christian Catholic Church in Zion. And there to meet Daniel Bryant on the Durban Harbor was Leroux. He went back with Leroux to Wakkerstroom, and there 140 of his congregation and Leroux and his wife were all baptized in the river. Wakkerstroom. Has anybody ever heard of Wakkerstroom? You've heard of Wakkerstroom. Anybody been there? All right. So it does exist. Huh? Believe it or not, Wakkerstroom is actually the Jerusalem of the Amazioni in South Africa. That's really where the whole movement began. Because now Pierre Leroux was ordained as an overseer of the Christian Catholic Church in Zion. But that wasn't the end. He had a branch in Joburg. So he spent quite a bit of time moving between Wakkerstroom and Johannesburg. And in 1908, Two American Pentecostal missionaries, Thomas Hesmelach and John G. Lake, arrived in South Africa straight from Azusa Street and began preaching in a holiness church in Bree Street. The Pentecostal movement actually has grown out of the holiness movement. Pentecostalism is really holiness doctrine with tongues added on as a necessary requirement. Essentially, it's a growth. So there, Thomas Hesmelach and John G. Lake were having their meetings, and Pierre Leroux went along to the meetings. Initially, he was repelled. After all, he was brought up Dutch Reformed, and the noise and the shouting was a little bit too much for him. But he went back and, in fact, soon became totally converted to the Pentecostal movement. And he was told, you know, Zion has got water and healing, but it hasn't got the Spirit and tongues. So now you enter into the whole thing by getting the Spirit and tongues. He went back to his church in Wakkerstroom to tell his congregation of this kind of new development, that they were now going to become apostolic faith mission people. But they said, no, but we're Zion. We like Zion. They become attached to this concept of Zion. And now, after a while, the AFM said, well, we'll regard them as our Zionist branch. Pierre Leroux, after John G. Lake left back to America, Pierre Leroux became the first president of the Apostolic Faith Mission in South Africa, which is still the largest classical Pentecostal church in this country. What happened back in Wakkerstroom? Many of his very able followers started kind of breaking off. We'll come to them later, and that's the beginning of the Zionist movement. But notice at this point, the beginnings of Zionism and the multitude of the Zionist churches are the same beginnings of the Apostolic Faith Mission Church. They just went in two different directions. You see, Pierre Leroux had the advantage of his Reformed teaching background, which some of his African colleagues didn't have. And that background kind of kept him, although he became thoroughly Pentecostal, he became regular Pentecostal, Orthodox Pentecostal, but not all of his African colleagues did so. I'm going to skip over very quickly other Pentecostal churches formed here, the Full Gospel Church of God. I must just mention, by the way, a mighty man of God, J.F. Rowlands, who was part of the Full Gospel Church, who was led by God to do an astonishing work among the Indians. Anybody heard of the Bethesda churches in Natal? They are probably the largest Christian denomination among the Indians, anyway, in Natal. And they were founded by the very godly man, J.F. Rowlands, and his brother. We could mention the Assemblies of God. And again, a great name comes to my mind, Nicholas Bengu. Who's heard of Nicholas Bengu? Not too many hands. You know, some of South Africa's greatest Christians are unknown. And some of the lousiest Christians, I'm not going to mention their names, are known too well. Bengu was attracted to Marxism as a youth. He became an active worker in the Communist Party in Kimberley. In 1929, he attended a Full Gospel evangelistic crusade in Kimberley, held by two American evangelists. He surrendered his life to Christ. In 1945, he began holding meetings in Port Elizabeth, which were marked by changed lives. They say that when he preached, at the end of his message, the stage would be filled with guns and knives and stolen goods as the people came under deep conviction of sin and came and surrendered those various things to him. Thousands attended his services. The whole of East London was moved. Coming back to the Amazioni, and I'm looking at the watch here, I'm going to have to go very fast because this is one of the most complicated and complex forms. There are thousands of Zionist churches in South Africa. The total number of them is millions, 10 million and more probably, much more. Some of the early ones, in 1970, Elias Mahlangu founded the Zion Apostolic Church of South Africa. Somewhere between 1912, Daniel Nkonyane, who was Pierre Leroux's convert, a very impressive man, founded the Christian Catholic Apostolic Holy Spirit Church in Zion. Now, you notice the length. One characteristic of the Zionist churches is they put their pedigree and their theology in their title. And every word actually means something. You know, Christian, Catholic, Apostolic, Christian, Catholic Church in Zion, that comes from Dawei. Apostolic, that comes from Azusa Street. Apostolic Holy Spirit. So basically, they kind of embrace in their title what they stand for, in most cases. Some of them have got really weird names, like the Holy Catholic Church, King George Win the War Church of Zion in South Africa. But we won't go there. Edward Motaung and the Zion Apostolic Faith Mission Church. He did a tremendous work in Lesotho. Now, some of these early Zionist leaders were actually also AFM pastors. Or they were considered the Zion branch of AFM. Only later did the two streams begin to separate, AFM and Amazioni. Probably the, not probably, definitely, the very largest Zionist church in South Africa is the ZCC, the Zion Christian Church, founded by Ingenes Lekhanyane. He came to Joburg to seek healing for an eye disease. He was came into contact with Elias Mahlangu of the Zion Apostolic Church. He probably had contact with Pierre Leroux. Later on, he kind of formed his own church. And in 1930, he purchased a farm, Moria, up near Polokwane. And that is still the headquarters of the ZCC, where hundreds and thousands of them go every year. We haven't got time to mention Manku and the Centre Apostolic First Mission. We haven't got time to talk about Isaiah Shembe and the Ama Nazareta, because time has run out. But these churches have spread. Unfortunately, in the most part, they've lost the plot in the main. Many of these Zionist people are very earnest people, but with very little grasp of the gospel. Many of them are focused on their leader, whoever it might be, Lekhanyane, Shembe. In fact, the Shembeites consider their leader to be God. And we could go into much of that, but I have to go all over it again. And you know something? I've missed out, and I have to miss out, the whole struggle, you know, with the Dutch Reformed Church, the South African Council of Churches, and eventually the rise of apartheid, the fall of apartheid. But we've just run out of time. I could talk about Albert Tutuli, Beyers Nodir, but I'm going to leave you a few minutes for questions. Sorry, we ran out of time there. Yes, my brother, right there. I beg your pardon? This paper, by the way, is available if you want to ask Robin. And you can, it's the modern, I think the title is The Modern Church. I actually have written a book on the story of the church in South Africa, which with a lot of detail in it, particularly of the Zionist churches. It's out of print, but Langham Partnership are in the process of reprinting it. So hopefully in the process of this year, the book will become available. Yes, and then I saw hands here somewhere. Yes.
I want to know what the role was that Freemasonry played in the growth of, well,
okay,
basically corrupting the South African church.
Yeah, that's a big topic on its own. Let me say pretty simply here, Freemasonry is an old thing. It dates from the 18th century. It is established in most Protestant countries, England, South Africa, America. It is really a mixture. It's really a manifestation of the old 18th century deism. You know, basically natural religion, one God, and all religions are really the same. And they got the same message. You got to be good. It's a secret society. And it has special initiation rites. What role has it played? Not a major one, but not a good one. Because whenever people become involved in the Freemasonries, they are under pressure to absorb Freemasonry doctrine, which is really deism, with a bit of mixture of Rosicrucianism and a few other things thrown into the recipe as well. So although there have been some good Christians, I think, who have been part of the Freemasonry movement. It hasn't been a good influence. It's not a helpful contact. But in terms of its major role in the big picture, I think it's limited. It tends to be limited to educated, wealthy English businessmen, in short. Although there are Afrikaner, black and others and Indians in it. But that tends to be it. Any other questions? I saw a hand somewhere here. Yes, Tim.
Thank you very much, Kevin, for everything today. I've heard you make a good comment. I have two questions, unrelated pretty much. And you give such masterful, brief answers. Maybe the minor question, first of all, then maybe the last one, a closing one. The Hebrew Roots movement, a current kind of, I've heard you even say it's one of South Africa's own homegrown heresies. We still hear a lot about it. Your thoughts?
I'm not sure actually if Hebrew Roots is a homegrown heresy. I have a feeling it has strong links from America. It arises out of earnest Christians with good motives who develop an interest and a love for Israel. What's wrong with that? Nothing at all. But a good thing can degenerate into a bad thing. And in some cases, it has become almost an obsession with all things Israeli and Jewish and Hebrew, so that the whole thing becomes to get closer to God, we must get closer to Hebrew. And we must start even using Hebrew terms. We don't talk about Jesus. We talk about Yeshua HaMashiach. We talk about Kadosh, And the more Hebrew you become, the closer you're getting to your Hebrew roots, the closer you're getting to God. It develops to the point, unfortunately, when it becomes cultic, that people begin to say, we can't have anything to do with the church anymore because they're neglecting the Torah. There's a tremendous emphasis on the Torah, back to the law. That's what the church has neglected. So back to Hebrew, back to the law, back to Israel. And then they become very anti. The church is pagan. It observes Easter and Christmas. These are pagan festivals. We should be observing. The Hebrew Roots movement is doing everything that the book of Galatians says we shouldn't do. In one word. And what's your other question?
Maybe then a final question, because I know our time is up, but I think it would be an appropriate note to end on. The Protestant Reformation has, other than missions, Africa has never had a biblical Protestant Reformation. What would it take?
Look, the Protestant Reformation as such is something that happened in Europe in the 16th century. Now, how much has Africa benefited from that? Well, it has, because whatever fruits of the Protestant Reformation, the Protestant churches, the Protestant missions are all rooted in the Protestant Reformation. Maybe, let me interpret your question a little bit. What I pray for a great deal, and I see signs of, is that in the African instituted churches, you know, all these Zionist churches, which have lost the plot. They've got a lot of zeal, a lot of interest, a lot of commitment, but the gospel has been lost. That's what happened in medieval Europe. You had a lot of religion, a lot of superstition, a lot of rituals, but little understanding of the gospel. And in a way, that is what has happened in many African Amazioni churches. But you have probably met our friend Sipho Mfusi. And just a very quick little testimony to finish that off. He grew up in the NDJ, Holy Catholic Ethiopian Church of God in Zion, something like that. A typical Zionist church. And they are very strict in particular in the sense they don't have any contact. They regard white churches as all corrupted and polluted. But he landed up because of his job in Australia. There's no branches of the NDJ church there. So he didn't go to any church. But his wife, who was fearful that he'd be converted to Australian booze and beer, persuaded him to go to a Presbyterian church. It happened to be an evangelical Presbyterian church. And for the first time in his life, he heard the gospel. And it was completely different to everything he had grown up with, which was law-orientated, ritual-orientated, works-orientated, with no inkling, actually, of the gospel. Well, he was soundly converted. And his job next took him to Washington, and he landed up in Devers Church. God had a plan with this man. And from Devers Church, he went to George Whitefield Theological College to get a sound theological training. And he's back in the NDJ church working a reformation. He needs enormous patience. The old archbishop publicly denounced him by name. And, you know, and he had to just sit there and take it. But God is working among him. And some of the young people are getting converted. And, in fact, the old man eventually he had to retire. And the new bishop in Zondi, whom they've appointed, is a friend and has come very humbly to Sipho and said, please help me. I need to learn. We want to learn. So African pastors' conferences are being held for their people. If what that is a reformation going on in a deteriorated church. If that can happen and be multiplied in other churches, something wonderful is happening in this country. Okay, thanks. Thank you very much all for enduring so long.